Ayatollah Khamenei says Iran has turned sanctions to opportunities aimed at progress, a clear example of which can be seen in the arms industry. Iran's President Raisi inaugurates a major multi-purpose engineering project during his official visit to Sri Lanka. And the UN Human Rights Office demands an independent probe into mass graves recently discovered in Gaza's hospitals. This is News. Thanks for joining us. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says the nation has turned sanctions into opportunities for big progress, a clear example of which is in the arms industry. Ayatollah Khamenei said, however, that the Iranian nation, thanks to their zeal and long Islamic traditions, did not submit to such coercion. He underlined that Iranians were able to make the enemy's sanction ploys futile and that pressures helped them make progress. The leader reiterated that the sanctions will not destroy the nation's resolve because Iranians are not looking for help from outside the borders. Ayatollah Khamenei added that the people worldwide are now supporting Palestinians because they have realized that resistance is not terrorism, rather a means to defend land and homes from the occupying regime. Ayatollah Khamenei was addressing workers who had gathered from all over the country in Tehran on the occasion of Labor Week. Glenn Deason is a Norwegian professor in political science. He says he believes long-term sanctions help the targeted countries thrive in different fields, and Iran is one such example.
If you have the sanctions which are too strong and are perpetual, that is, they're continued over a long period of time, what actually happens is that the sanctioned countries learn to live without the belligerent. And so what you see in Iran can also be compared to Russia, but also China. That is, these countries, they largely begin to decouple themselves from the U.S.-led international economic system. And given that the U.S. international economic system is, to a large extent, very rent-seeking, we see that they can often thrive. So there's a lot of reason behind this argument, as they learn then to live without American technologies, without their industries, without their transportation corridors, without their banks, without their currencies. And with the absence of rent-seeking, we actually see that countries can eventually thrive if they're able to reduce their reliance on those who use economic dependence as a weapon.
Sri Lankan President Ranil Wickremesinghe has officially welcomed the Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi in the capital, Colombo. The Iranian President is visiting the South Asian nation as part of a one-day official visit, which marks a significant diplomatic boost between Tehran and Colombo. Two sides have signed several memorandums of understanding aimed at bolstering bilateral relations. President Raisi has also inaugurated the Oma Oya multipurpose development project. The project includes two dams and a 120-megawatt power plant built by Iranian contractors. During the inauguration ceremony, President Raisi and the Islamic Republic is implementing large hydroelectric projects in more than 20 countries, thanks to its technical and engineering capabilities. Majid Tayafi is a civil manager at Oma Oya Project, who joins us. Well, welcome to the program. Tell us about the project itself and why it's deemed to be such a huge deal in terms of what it can do.
Project Oma Oya یک مگا پروژه در کشور سریلانکا هستش که در واقع این پروژه در بخش وسیع از استان اووا قرار گرفته و هدف اصلی پروژه انتقال آب از مناطق
کوهستانی agriculture because of the mountainous terrain. So it gives it provides further opportunity for agriculture because of the elevation difference. This project creates the right capacity for generation of electricity. So at the same time, the electricity is also generated in addition to carrying water. The project is almost 40 kilometers long, and it almost takes 2 hours to destination. In the upstream, we have two dams for The name of the project also is taken after the river name. The water is collected and then through a tunnel, a linking tunnel, is then carried to the second dam. That's 4 kilometers long. The second dam is over Mahatir Jalaoya River, and the collected water, together with the water that's carried from Polpola Dam to this dam, together through a tunnel which is 15 kilometers long, it's transferred to another region. At the end of the tunnel, we have there is a shaft. It's actually a tunnel, another tunnel, which is a vertical one. It's almost 18 meters. At the end of this tunnel and beneath it, we have the Umoja power plant. It's actually a subterranean power plant 750 meters under the ground. Now, after generation of power in Umoja power plant, through a tunnel that's 3.7 kilometers long, the water exits the power plant and pours into another river. So the main purpose is actually to carry the water to the plains for the sake of agricultural purposes. It's the plains of Sri Lanka, actually. So the power generated in the power plant is this 2 kilometer access tunnel where the power is transferred to, and we changed through the voltage difference. There is another aerial 1 kilometer line that carries the electricity to another center. The whole prizes that I just mentioned have been connected by our colleagues, Iranian colleagues, and all these elements are actually part of our job description, the Umoja project. The designing, the execution, the commissioning have been done by an EPC contractor, and part of our, we have done it from A to Z. And it's now fully operational. The main challenges, we could say, the tunnel that's too long, it's 15 kilometers. A special kind of drilling has been used. No access from the sites. Only through the entrance and the exit point, the drilling and digging has been conducted. Because of the geographical location where the tunnel is, water has very high pressure. 25 bars, that's almost 250 meters water pressure. This is what we've gone through. So we can say that in the implementation of this project, given the sensitivity of the employer for water sealing and also to do something that would not allow the water to penetrate, I can say that we have used the latest technology to do this, be it in terms of material or the modus operandi of the execution of the project. So this has been in collaboration with the, from European countries and from Iran, the highest ranking officials have been cooperating with us, and we have used their service in this sealing. And this has been an invaluable experience for us. And the the other tunnel that I told you about, the vertical one, that has been a unique one, and it has no side access, and we have used the latest technology to build that. It's also 120 megawatts in, I think he said 90 megawatts of electricity generated. I can't hear properly.
Okay, great. Thank you very much for that. We do appreciate it. Thank you. Majid Tayafi there, civil manager at Umoja there for the Umoja project. Thank you so much. Moving on, Iran and Pakistan, meanwhile, have urged the UN Security Council to take action against Israel. The joint statement was issued by Pakistan's foreign ministry on Wednesday, after Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi wrapped up his three-day visit to the South Asian country. The joint statement condemns Israel's hostile acts, saying that the regime has illegally targeted neighboring countries and foreign diplomatic missions, violation of international law. Two sides also condemned Israel's aggression against the Palestinian people, along with the inhumane blockade of Gaza. Muslim neighbors, Iran and Pakistan, have agreed to adopt a collaborative approach to confront militant violence. President Raisi concluded his visit to Pakistan and flew to Sri Lanka on Wednesday. The UN Human Rights Office is calling for an immediate and independent investigation following the discovery of mass graves at the vicinity of destroyed hospitals in Gaza.
We are horrified also by the destruction of Al-Nasser Medical Complex and Al-Shifa Medical Complex and the reports of the discovery of mass graves in and around facilities. And we call for independent, effective, transparent investigations into the deaths. Given the prevailing climate of impunity, this should include international investigators. Hospitals are entitled to very special protection under international humanitarian law. And let's be clear, the intentional killing of civilians, detainees, and others who are hors de combat is a war crime.
In a press conference in Geneva, Rabina Shamdasani also called the mass graves a serious violation of international human rights law and international humanitarian law. Despite all criticisms, the Israeli regime has continued its genocidal war in Gaza with the full support of its Western allies. The regime massacres civilians by pounding the blockaded territory with more airstrikes and artillery fire. Since the onset of the war in early October, over 34,260 Gazans have been killed, most of them women and children. Our correspondent Muti Abu Musaba joined us earlier from the central Gaza city of Deir al-Balah to update on the latest Israeli killing of civilians in the besieged coastal strip.
Yes, actually, the last night was horrific for all Palestinian civilians here in Gaza Strip, whereas the Israeli occupation forces intensified and ramped up the attacks against all areas of Gaza Strip. Here in the central area of Gaza Strip, the last attack actually claimed the lives of four Palestinian civilians after the Israeli warplanes carried out an airstrike against a group of the Palestinian civilians in Al-Nusayrat refugee camp. In the meantime, those attacks were intensified and continued against the northern part of Al-Nusayrat refugee camp. Ceaseless Israeli airstrikes hit those areas amid the continuous and the chronic artillery shelling that was maintained against Al-Mughraga neighborhood and Al-Zahra town, in addition to the northern part of Al-Nusayrat refugee camp. Here in Deir al-Balah city, the Israeli warplanes actually carried out another airstrike against a civilian car in the center of Deir al-Balah city. At least a Palestinian civilian was reportedly killed over the attack, in addition to multiple injuries. In the meantime, the Israeli artillery shelling was maintained against the eastern part of Deir al-Balah city. When it comes to Gaza city, the Israeli warplanes also scaled up their attacks against different neighborhoods inside Gaza city, including At-Tufah, Al-Shija'iyya, and Zaytun neighborhood. Those areas were under heavy bombardment. The northern part of the Gaza Strip, the current situation is still hyper-hazardous as the Israeli occupation forces renewed their intense attacks against those areas, particularly Beit Lahia city. As you know, the Israeli occupation forces demanded the people who are still there to evacuate the entire city.
The Israeli army says it has made all preparations to launch its long-awaited military offensive against Rafah, south of the besieged Gaza Strip. A senior Israeli official says the military is awaiting a cabinet approval. According to U.S. media, Israel is planning to move the civilians in Rafah to the nearby city of Khan Yunis over a period of 2 or 3 weeks. It would then send troops into Rafah gradually, targeting areas where they claim leaders of Palestinian resistance movement Hamas are residing in. The operation is expected to last 6 weeks. Some 1.5 million people are sheltering in Rafah, many of them in makeshift camps. International aid groups have warned that any invasion would create an apocalyptic situation in Rafah. Hamas says the invasion could or would be a crime and that central Gaza and Khan Yunis cannot accommodate the displaced people from Rafah. Israeli forces have shot and killed a Palestinian girl in the occupied West Bank over an alleged stabbing attack against the regime forces. The 20-year-old, identified as Maimouna Abdelhamid Harasha, was shot in the head near the city of Al-Khalil. Occupation forces also prevented the ambulance crew from reaching the victim. The Israeli army claimed that the young woman was trying to carry out a stabbing attack against troops at a military post near the village of Beit Hanun. Tensions have been running high across the West Bank since Israel launched its genocidal war in Gaza last October. Nearly 480 Palestinians have been killed in the regime's attacks over the past 6 months in the occupied territories. Hundreds of Israeli settlers backed by the regime forces have once again broken into the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound in occupied Al-Quds on the second day of the Jewish Passover holiday. That is while non-Muslims, under decades-long agreements, are not allowed to perform their religious rituals at Islam's third holiest site. Our Ramallah correspondent Mona Kandil earlier joined us with more details.
It's the second day of the Jewish holiday known as Passover that started yesterday and will last for 1 week, a whole 1 week. The Israeli settlers, over 500 settlers, had raided the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex, Al-Haram al-Sharif, and at the same time, the Israeli forces prevented Palestinians from entering the Al-Aqsa Mosque and its complex during the same period when the settlers were allowed to storm into the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex. At the same time, Israeli forces were deploying around the Al-Aqsa Mosque in the roads of the old town leading to the Al-Aqsa Mosque, and more Israeli police officers and soldiers were stationing at the gates leading to the Al-Aqsa Mosque as well, preventing Palestinians, specifically Palestinian youths, from entering the old town of Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. And those who were allowed to enter the Al-Aqsa Mosque for prayers, the Israeli forces held their ID cards and gave them cards with numbers on them in order to make sure that they have their names, they have their information. We expect more raids by the Israeli settlers in the coming hours. And we have also to mention that at the same time when the settlers are storming the Al-Aqsa Mosque complex, Israeli police are escorting those Israeli settlers to inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque to ensure, of course, the safety and the security, of course, of those Israeli settlers while doing their utmost to prevent the Palestinians, the Muslims, from praying inside the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
And that is it for World News. Bye-bye for now.
Diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
The Limelight. Tom Cotton, the bellicose U.S. senator from Arkansas, has voiced specific support for violence and inflicting pain on pro-Palestinian protesters. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. The Electronic Intifada wrote, Tom Cotton, the bellicose U.S. senator from Arkansas, is not satisfied with pushing to employ the U.S. military against Black Lives Matter and Antifa protesters. He is now encouraging vigilance violence against Gaza genocide activists. Recently, he proposed throwing protesters in American cities off bridges. He urged people stuck in traffic related to Gaza genocide protest to take violent action. He said, I encourage people who get stuck behind the pro-Hamas mobs blocking traffic, take matters into your own hands to get them out of the way. Protesters for Palestinian freedom are pro-Hamas mobs to Cotton, a man who inveighs against overtaxing but on the American tax day, promotes bodily harm against those protesting U.S. tax money, fueling war crimes and genocide. Speaking to Fox News about protesters blocking traffic in demonstrations from California to Illinois to New York and elsewhere, Cotton said, if something like this happened in Arkansas on a bridge there, let's just say I think there would be a lot of very vet criminals that have been tossed overboard, not by law enforcement, but by the people whose road they are blocking, unquote. Then voicing specific support for violence and inflicting pain on protesters, Cotton asserted, if they glued their hands to a car or the pavement, well, probably pretty painful to have their skin ripped off. But I think that's the way we'd handle it in Arkansas. And I would encourage most people anywhere that get stuck behind criminals like this, who are trying to block traffic, to take matters in their own hands. Hatam Abu Daya, National Chair of the U.S.-Palestinian Community Network, USPCN, told to the Electronic Intifada, it's really unbelievable in this day and age that a sitting U.S. senator can threaten violence to protesters and not be sanctioned or censured or anything else by his colleagues. It's been an incredible challenge in the past 6 months, especially, to experience what Palestinians have in the U.S., that our lives are expensive, that our rights aren't defended, that our very existence is threatened. But we can't and won't back down, and we will continue fighting to stop the genocide and make sure that racist, white, supremacist apologies for Israel like Tom Cotton will see a free Palestine in his lifetime. The American Civil Liberties Union did not respond to requests from the Electronic Intifada for First Amendment analysis on how much latitude Cotton has to encourage vigilance violence against protesters. Recently, Cotton also weighed in regarding a report that the International Criminal Court could bring international arrest warrants in the relatively near future against Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and other top officials for war crimes. Cotton, attempting to intimidate the court and its officials, said he was putting ICC officials on notice. He added, if you side with Hamas and Iran and enter the political battlefield against Israel, you will be sanctioned. Get your dollars out of the U.S. now and say goodbye to ever visiting America again, he said. He's clearly worried that a fair appraisal will find the child-killing regime of Israel has committed war crimes in Gaza and with U.S. arms. Meanwhile, the House of Representatives passed a resolution deeming the chant "From the River to the Sea, Palestine will be free" to be anti-Semitic. Just 43 Democrats voted against the resolution and one Republican. Unsurprisingly, many Democrats ended up on the side of noted anti-Semite and Islamophobe Marjorie Taylor Greene, a congressional QAnon enthusiast from the state of Georgia. The representatives aren't interested in addressing anti-Semitism with a resolution, but in restricting speech related to Palestinian freedom. Many supporters of the chant are strong supporters of equal rights for all those living between the Jordan River and the Mediterranean Sea and oppose an apartheid regime of Israel, carrying out what the International Court of Justice has deemed a plausible genocide in Gaza. Most of the Palestinians in the coastal territory are there as a consequence of Zionist militias and the Zionist regime military dispossessing and displacing their grandparents and great-grandparents into Gaza in 1948. Many have family land that was stolen from them just a few miles away. The hypocrisy and wars of House members is clear. They had nothing to say about the Zionist regime Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's map presented in September 2023 at the United Nations, depicting all of the land between the river and the sea and the occupied Golan Heights as part of the fabricated regime of Israel. Yair Netanyahu, the Prime Minister's son, triumphantly claims on his Twitter, X, feed to his nearly 200,000 followers that from the river to the sea, this flag of Israel is all you will see. The apartheid vision of father and son is widely accepted or disregarded in the U.S. Congress. From co-sponsors of the River to the Sea resolution, Michael Lawler and Max Miller on the far right to Jamie Raskin and Sheila Sharfless McCormick, who are supposedly on the left. Miller, of course, received no censure last year for his genocidal call to turn Gaza into a parking lot. Calls for equal rights for Palestinians are now hate speech to most members of the U.S. House of Representatives. University students and activists will pay a price, but such congressional foolishness is apt to lead to even more people questioning U.S. policies opposing Palestinian freedom. More unconditioned military aid to the Zionist regime, some $17 billion approved today by the U.S. House of Representatives, with just 58 members dissenting, will only make for more Israeli regime war crimes and with deeper U.S. complicity. Roughly $9 billion in humanitarian aid for areas devastated by war was approved, including an anticipated $2 billion for Palestinians in Gaza. The New York Times confuses very few when it says this military aid comes in the context of scores of Palestinian civilian casualties. In fact, the Zionist regime's military genocidal action with the backing of U.S. arms has resulted in tens of thousands of Palestinian civilian casualties since October 7th.
the ocean of dua.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters, I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarisi with you with another edition of the program, The Ocean of Dua. In this edition of the program, we will be with you with the explanation of Dua ul-Kumail, the commentary of different parts of this Kumail supplication by the commander of the faithful Imam Ali alayhi salam. We'll be back after you listen to the parts we're going to discuss.
Ya sari'a rida, ighfir li man la yamliku illa ad-du'a, fa innaka fa'alun lima tasha'a.
Brothers and sisters, we have reached this excerpt of the Divine Kumail Supplication. Ya sari'a rida, ighfir liman la yamliku illa ad-du'a, fa innaka fa'alun lima tasha'. O he whose pleasure is quickly achieved, forgive him who owns nothing but supplication, for you do what you will. يا من اسمه دواء وذكره شفاء وطاعته غناء. O he whose name is remedy, whose remembrance is cure, and whose obedience is wealth. ارحم من رأس ماله الرجاء وسلاحه البكاء. Have mercy upon him whose capital is hope and whose weapon is tears. Brothers and sisters, Allah's pleasure is quickly achieved by a servant who is under his wrath due to wrongdoing and has resorted to beseeching and repentance afterwards. Because Allah's mercy, Allah's love, Allah's generosity, it is infinite. And that's why someone who has committed sins for even years without any lapses is forgiven by only a moment of repentance, by only a moment of regret, and his few deeds are accepted and attended to. Of course, he has to make up for what he has skipped of his actions, obligatory actions, and the rights of the people whom he has missed, of course. But his repentance, his regret is accepted. Therefore, Amir al-Mu'mineen Ali alayhi salam, after the divine phrase, O whose pleasure is quickly achieved, Ya Sari' al-Rida, states, اغفر لمن لا يملك إلا الدعاء. Forgive him who owns nothing but supplication. Why? Because a real sincere supplication implies the supplicant's poverty and meanness, and that he owns no means of worship. He owns nothing of obedience or good deeds to be forgiven for. That he owns no benefit or loss. He cannot remove any evil or gain any good. The supplicant has not come to Allah's presence but with your assistance and mercy. If Allah your mercy had not attracted him, the supplicant could not utter the supplicating phrases. He couldn't have said even a word of these supplicating phrases. And he could not weep for some moments. Such a servant, of course, is worthy of your mercy and benevolence. He should call upon you. The generous does not ask a poor servant about what he has brought. Rather, he, subhanahu wa ta'ala, asks about what he wants. So you have said that if the servant comes one step towards me, I would take 10 steps towards him. My Lord, I am so needful, I am so disabled that I cannot come towards you even as much as one step. But I want to. You take his step towards me that so that I would get free of satanic desires and carnal soul, so that I would get subjected to your mercy.
Oh, he who is readily pleased, forgive one who owes nothing but supplications to you. You do what you will. Oh, he whose name is the remedy, and whose remembrance is a sure cure for all ailments, and obedience to whom makes one self-sufficient. Have mercy on one whose only asset is hope, and whose only armor is weeping. Oh, he who perfected all bounties, and who wards off all misfortune. Oh, light who illuminates those who are in darkness. Oh, omniscient who knows without learning. Bless Muhammad and the progeny of Muhammad, and do unto me in accordance with that which befits you.
Thank you, Allah, now that we're here, feeling so good about all the things that we went through, knowing that God is pleased with us too. It's not a dream, this is so true, feeling the peace all around, seeing things we can never imagine, hearing the sound of rivers flow, and we know we'll be here forever. The feeling is indescribable, knowing that this is our reward.
The ocean of dua.
So dear listeners, Imam Ali alayhi salam talks to the Almighty Allah by calling him Ya Sari Ar-Ridha. This calling him, O whose pleasure is quickly achieved, can mean two things. The first is that Imam Amir al-Mu'mineen alayhi salam is teaching us that you have to return to Almighty Allah knowing that He is Sari Ar-Ridha. If you want to supplicate to your Lord, if you want to talk to your Lord, if you want to be forgiven, you have to realize that He is the only one who is Sari Ar-Ridha. He is the only one who is quickly achieved. Because you have got nothing to present to Him, you have got nothing to be forgiven for, but yet, even at this moment, He is Sari Ar-Ridha. Imam Ali alayhi salam is teaching us the method, the prerequisite of acceptance of supplications. اغفر لمن لا يملك إلا الدعاء. Yet, even this sinful, regretful servant has one thing, and that is nothing but supplication. Ya Sari Ar-Ridha, O the one whose pleasure is quickly achieved, forgive him who owns nothing, not even a single good deed, but illa du'a, but supplication. فَإِنَّكَ فَعَالٌ لِمَا تَشَى. So you do what you will. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. وَالسَّلَامُ عَلَيْكُمْ وَرَحْمَةُ اللَّهِ وَبَرَكَاتُهُ.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.ir. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah. Ya Allah, ya Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you by my side. I wish to be close to you through half my life. Ya Allah, oh Allah, be with me all the way.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day, from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Southern Africa can tune in to the English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz, every day, from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAT 5 and IntelSat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. Now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
True promise. This was the code name of a retaliatory military action by Iran against Israel. On Saturday, April 13th, Iran's IRGC unleashed massive aerial assaults on Israeli positions from its own soil. The widespread operation, which lasted hours, deployed over 300 drones, cruise missiles, and ballistic missiles. The strike came in response to the Israeli regime's attack on the consular building of the Islamic Republic's embassy in the Syrian capital of Damascus on April 1st. The attack came as a blatant violation of all international conventions, especially the Geneva and Vienna conventions. 7 Iranian military advisors, including several top IRGC commanders, were killed in the airstrike. Brigadier General Mohammad Reza Zahedi, a commander of IRGC Quds Force, and his deputy General Mohammad Hadi Haji Rahimi were among those killed in the attack on the consular section of the Iranian embassy in Damascus. The Iranian military advisors are in Syria for more than a decade, at the official invitation of the Syrian government to help fight Takfiri groups, including Daesh terrorists, which ironically enough have never attacked Israel. This has given rise to speculations that the Israeli regime is helping terrorists to destabilize the sovereign countries in the West Asian region. The regime is already accused of supporting the terrorists in Syria. Back in 2014, a controversial video showed top Israeli officials, including Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, visiting Syrian militants wounded in the battle with government forces. Footage clearly showed how Israel was quietly cultivating ties with terrorists in Syria, providing medical care and other unidentified supplies to them. The April 1st strike by Israel targeting Iranian military advisors in Syria was not unprecedented. The regime has a long history of killing Iranian commanders, which is seen as part of its desperate attempts to undermine resistance movements in the region. Israel has also assassinated several Iranian scientists and launched sabotage attacks against Iran's nuclear facilities in recent years. Shortly after the Israeli strikes on April 1st, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Khamenei, announced that the Zionist regime would pay a price. The barrage of Iranian missiles and drones targeted a large intelligence base in the occupied lands and Israel's Nevatim airspace, from where an F-35 jet took off to target Iran's diplomatic premises in Damascus on April 1st. The Iranian strike on Israel sparked celebrations not only in Iranian cities, but also in other countries, including Yemen, Lebanon, and especially Palestine and Gaza, where Israel has already carried out a genocide resulting in the deaths of more than 32,000 people. In the West Bank city of Jenin, Palestinians expressed gratitude for Iran's attack. The strike has resonated deeply with those who have long endured Israeli aggression and oppression, offering a glimmer of hope and solidarity in their struggle for justice and freedom. Although the Israeli regime asserted that it successfully intercepted most of the missiles and drones, informed sources reveal a different narrative. The Israeli regime and its allies reportedly faltered in intercepting any of the hypersonic missiles launched by Iran, resulting in the damage to Israeli military bases across the occupied territories. Major General Mohammad Bagheri, Chief of Staff of the Iranian Armed Forces, affirmed that the strikes achieved their objectives, highlighting the failure of the Israeli regime's Iron Dome system to effectively counter Iranian missiles and drones.
Well, it's obvious that it was a major humiliation for the Israeli regime. They crossed the red line and they got punished for it. Of course, the Israelis can say 110% of the drones and missiles were downed. That's fine, but they can also take journalists to see the bases that the Iranians have said were severely damaged. They can easily do that today or tomorrow.
Iran's retaliatory strike, while significant, is viewed as just the initial step. Analysts emphasize that the strike, although impactful, represents only a fraction of Iran's potential response capabilities. They warn that if the Israeli regime decides to escalate the conflict further by launching an attack on Iran, the retaliation from Iran is likely to be exponentially more severe. This initial action is regarded as a strategic signal of Iran's preparedness to defend itself and its interests, setting the stage for potential future confrontations with Israel.
Back in 2013, the leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, warned the Israeli officials against threatening the Islamic Republic. He said any military invasion by the regime against Iran would result in destruction of Tel Aviv and Haifa. Now, Iranian officials are issuing a solemn warning, emphasizing that the retaliatory measures taken against Israel on April 13th, carried out within the confines of self-defense, signify a pivotal moment in Iran's strategic approach. This significant action marks the culmination of Iran's era, characterized by strategic patience, suggesting a shift in the nation's stance towards safeguarding its interests and responding decisively to perceived threats. According to Iranian President's Deputy Chief of Staff for Political Affairs, Mohammad Jamshidi, Iran's retaliatory strikes on the Israeli-occupied territories signify the end of the strategic patience era. Iran's vow to punish Israel for its actions underscores the seriousness of the situation and the depth of Iran's commitment to defending its sovereignty and deterring further Israeli aggression. The strike serves as a warning to Israel that any future provocations will be met with swift and severe consequences.
Iran has more advanced drones and missiles, and the very fact that the Americans don't want to be a part of any Israeli counter-response shows that the Americans know where the power lies. So the smart thing for the Israeli regime to do would be to refrain from responding. They got their punishment and they should live with it. They can say that 200% of the drones were down and 300% of the missiles were down, but as long as they keep quiet, they'll be safe. But if they strike Iran again, it's going to get much worse.
Tehran's assertion of its readiness to defend itself against external threats underscores its determination to maintain stability and security in the region. Some analysts view Iran's unprecedented attack on Israel as a calculated move aimed at maintaining a balance of power in the region and preventing further destabilization to deter Israeli aggression and bolster Iran's deterrence capabilities.
This was, I call it, one of the greatest military demonstrations in modern history, because by doing what they did, Iran not only put Israel into check, but believe it or not, they have created a foundation for peace and stability in the Middle East by eliminating from consideration options that Israel and the United States may have been considering down the road, such as a preemptive strike against Iranian nuclear facilities.
Operation True Promise was Iran's first direct military action against Israel. It was a limited operation, a slap in the face of the regime. The next operation, if necessary, will be totally different.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 MHz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on IranSat or BAD 5 and Intelsat 39 and via the internet. Our internet address is pasttoday.ir/en. And now you can listen to Arabi English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. We'll be right back.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.